The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight, I thought I'd talk about suffering. And using it as a guide or as a teacher for us, you know, what we can learn and how we can learn from our suffering. So to start that, I want to say a few words about what the Buddhist understanding of suffering is. There are different ways that the term dukkha, which is the term usually translated as suffering from the Pali, different ways that that term is used in the texts, in the Buddhist texts. And the main way, or one of the most important ways, is as it is used with respect to the First Noble Truth. And the way that it is understood with respect to the First Noble Truth, where the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering being that there is a wanting or a sense of not meeting experience as it is, and that the Third Noble Truth, that there's a possibility for the ending of that suffering, and the Fourth Noble Truth being that there is a path leading to the ending of that suffering. So the term dukkha, as it is used in the Four Noble Truths, means a kind of a reactivity to what is happening. So there is the experience that is happening, and then there is often a sense of just not being, things not feeling right around that, that we are kind of resisting what is happening, or we are trying to hold on and keep what is happening here, keeping it from slipping away. So there's a sense of kind of resisting or reacting to our experience. We react to things when they're unpleasant. When they're unpleasant, we don't like them, we want to get rid of them. When they're pleasant, we react by kind of wanting to hold on to them, wanting to keep them. And, you know, there can be a sense of, you know, it's when something is pleasant and we're going after it, there can be a dukkha around it if we don't get it. There can be a suffering around it if we don't manage to find a way to keep it in our lives. There can be immediate kind of suffering around that. Or if we somehow manage to get that thing, then there can be a sense of fear of loss around that. Or there can be a sense of anxiety around somebody coming to that might take it away from us. Or it may be that there's none of that, but that because that thing is inherently impermanent, it's going to go away at some point, there is a kind of a suffering around the loss of that when that happens. That may be sooner or later, but even when we get something, there is a kind of a suffering, there's a reactivity around things that we like. So sometimes Gill says, I don't know if Gill is the originator of this saying, but he's the first person I heard say it, so I will quote it as Gill. He says that, now the pain of life, that we are going to meet pain in our lives, in particular physical pain, is kind of inevitable. But suffering is optional. So that, you know, if you imagine some kind of pain in your life, some kind of physical pain, if there were no reactivity to that pain, would it be a problem? You know, would there be a problem around it? So this dukkha of the First Noble Truth is really around the kind of reactivity to our experience. So there's some different ways to express this in English, and the main way it's expressed is as the word suffering. This word, you know, it's a reasonably good translation, and yet in our language that word tends to mean something kind of large. You know, we think of suffering as being the big things that happen to us. One teacher, Steve Armstrong, says that he went to his first meditation retreat and he heard them talking about suffering all the time. And he said, I was sitting back there, you know, in the back of the room and my body hurt and I was kind of bored and I was kind of frustrated because I thought I was coming on a spa retreat. And here I was, you know, sitting here listening to these Dharma talks that I knew nothing about. But they were talking about the suffering thing. And I thought, you know, I don't have that. So, you know, that... that word can be a little bit off for us in a way. You know, it's not, we don't think about these smaller things, just a sense of frustration or things not quite being right, as being suffering. So this dukkha includes all of that. So Tanisaro Bhikkhu, one of the translators of the Pali texts and a regular visitor to this center, I think he comes pretty much every April or so. He'll be here again this year, I believe. He translates this term dukkha as stress. And this is a good translation, partly because, for two reasons I like this translation, because it points to the fact that the suffering, when we think of stress, we generally think of something happening in our minds. And this dukkha is a mental experience. The reactivity of the First Noble Truth, this dukkha of the First Noble Truth, refers to a mental reactivity. It's not referring to the physical discomfort that we have. It's referring to the way that we react to it. So that sense of stress conveys that sense of a mental reactivity. I think it also conveys a little bit of the subtlety that this term can convey. And dukkha includes a wide variety of, from the subtlest kind of things feeling just a little bit off through, you know, the stress around losing a partner or having a very serious illness, the suffering that we have, you know, when we lose a parent, all of that is included in dukkha, from the subtlest to the most extreme. One way I like to explore this term, and I've used this before perhaps in this class, I don't remember when I used this last in this class, but is to look at the derivation of the word dukkha. It's the Pali term dukkha has two parts to it, the du part and the ka part. And the du part means bad, something like bad. And my understanding is that the ka part means this empty space in the middle of a wheel. So basically the place where the axle would go through. And think about, you know, what is your ride going to be like if your wheel has a bad empty space in the middle? You know, that empty space might be bad in a number of ways. You know, it might be too tight so that the ride is just, you know, it's just like, it's a hard ride. It just doesn't roll smoothly. Or perhaps the axle, the hole in the middle, is a little off-center. So it's just a little, it's a little bumpy, you know. It's just not, it's not smooth. Or maybe that hole is just way too big for the axle and, you know, the wheel is going to fall off and you're going to crash and burn. So, you know, thinking about it in that sense as, you know, to me that really gives us a sense of the real breadth of the term. You know, from the subtlest kind of things just feel a little off to disaster. So I mentioned that there are some other ways that this word is used. This is the main way I want to speak about it today, about the dukkha of the First Noble Truth. But to be a little bit complete, I want to also mention the other ways that I know of that this term is used in the texts, just to be complete. Because I think sometimes, we can hear things, like you might hear that, the Buddha taught that everything is dukkha. And he did teach that, but there's a way in which he taught that that is specific. So the way in which he taught that particular thing, where every experience has this quality of dukkha, that's one of the ways that he spoke, that every experience has a quality of dukkha. What that means, this is a different way of using the term, is that every experience that we have is inherently unreliable. That there's no experience that we have, there's nothing that we can experience that we can find as a satisfying thing that we can hang our hat on and say, yep, that's going to do it for me. Because this is inherently related to the fact that every experience that we have is impermanent. It's impermanent actually in a very subtle way where things are kind of falling apart all the time. That any experience we have is in a continual state of coming into being and falling apart and coming into being and falling apart. And because of that, whatever we experience, there is no way that anything that we experience can possibly be the thing that we'd say, yep, that's what's going to do it for me. If we try to engage in that way, that electric car, that is what is going to do it for me. You know, that is what is going to do it for me. Well, so we get the electric car and we discover, it makes us feel good for a little while, but, it doesn't ultimately satisfy us. And so we end up kind of on this round of trying to find the next thing that will satisfy us, and the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. But everything that we experience is inherently unreliable. So that's another way of using the term, that the Buddha, basically this unreliability is intimately connected with the dukkha of the First Noble Truth, our mental reactivity, because our proclivity is to want to try to hang on to things, to want to try to construct the world so that we have what we want, we get rid of what we don't want, that we think somehow that that's what will make us happy, to arrange and construct our world to have the things that we want and get rid of the things that we don't want. So there's that wanting to have the things that we want and the wanting to get rid of the things that we don't want. And that the connection between the dukkha, that there is the inherent unreliability of all experience, and the dukkha of the First Noble Truth, is that we willfully ignore or think that we're somehow immune to this unreliability and think, no, I can actually do this. I can construct my life to have what I want all the time, to get rid of what I don't want. That is what having a happy life would be, to be able to do that. And so the kind of ignoring of that truth of the unreliability of experience and the belief that we can find something that will make us happy, something in our experience that will make us happy by holding on to it, that is the source of this dukkha of the First Noble Truth. So there's a connection between them. But this unreliability will continue whether or not we hold on to things. It's called a characteristic or a kind of an aspect of our experience. That it's just inherently there's nothing reliable in our experience as a place for a lasting happiness. So that's another way that this term dukkha is used. So I wanted to just put that out there. And then there's a third way I know of that it is used, and that is in terms of the unpleasant experience of body and of mind. When something is unpleasant, there's this there's a teaching around feeling tone to experience, that every experience we have has one of three flavors of feeling tone. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So we're kind of a neutral feeling tone. And that's, again, that's just the, that's just the quality of our experience. You know, that, you know, if we cut our finger with a knife, there will be unpleasant physical sensation. If we eat food that, you know, pleasant ice cream and chocolate, you know, that will be pleasant. There'll be a pleasant experience. Now, looking at white walls is kind of neutral, depending on your aesthetics. So there are those three feeling tones, and those arise with every experience. And the Pali term that's used for the unpleasant feeling tone is dukkha. So that's, again, that's a third way that it's used. So, but again, the dukkha of the First Noble Truth, the dukkha that the Buddha says we can be free of, is this mental reactivity. We're not going to become free of physical pain. That, again, that's that, you know, that's inevitable. You know, our bodies are designed to produce physical pain when they're damaged. It's actually a good thing that it does that, you know, that, that it helps to protect the body to do that. So that part's not going to go away. But the mental reactivity, that is what the Buddha said. It is possible. It is possible for this to end. Mental reactivity can come to an end. There's one description, I mentioned this on Monday night, there's one description of complete freedom, which is no mental pain and grief. That if there is, that ending of suffering means that there will be no mental pain and grief. So the dukkha of the First Noble Truth, this dukkha of reactivity, this suffering of reactivity. This is the suffering that I want to point to as being the kind of suffering that can be a teacher for us, that can be a guide for us. So part of the exploration around this dukkha is to begin to look at how is it created. Since it is a reactivity, you know, it is something that's happening in our minds. Now, there's things happening out there that we react to. But the actual reactivity is going on inside of our minds. So there's reactivity around when something is pleasant, we like it, we want it, we want to hold on to it. There's reactivity when something is unpleasant, we want to get rid of it. So this is kind of talking about the second noble truth, the cause of dukkha. And the Buddha said that it is this this wanting, this craving for things to be other than they are. So essentially this dukkha is related to not being aligned with this things, with the situation that is here in this moment. It's not being accepting or connected with the truth of the experience as it is right now. There's some sense of, it could be a little better, I need to fix it, I need to change it. And I'll come back to that in a minute. So the wanting things to be other than they are, the sense that if only I could change it, you know, this wanting to get rid of, the wanting to hold on to, if only I could satisfy that wanting, it's the wanting that is understood to be the cause of this dukkha, of this. Another translation could be dissatisfaction or unsatisfactoriness. So the wanting is kind of the source of this unsatisfactoriness. You know, if there weren't any wanting things to be different, would things be unsatisfactory? You know, if the wanting goes away, just kind of as a mind experiment, you could maybe play with that, you know? Just imagine something that you think is important for your life. Maybe not the biggest thing, but, you know, something that seems like it's pretty important. And, you know, so there's kind of a sense of that the wanting of that thing. If that wanting were to go away, would it be an issue if truly the wanting for that thing were to disappear? Would it be an issue if you don't have that thing? So this is what the Buddha is pointing to, that it is the wanting that it is the cause. So I want to point a little bit to these causes, because, you know, to kind of understand in the moment the wanting of something is a cause of our dissatisfaction. But at the same time, we do know, we have a sense that there's also all kinds of other things that come into our wanting. You know, other historical things, ways that we were raised, our genetic tendencies, how we were, how our friends reacted to us when we were kids, how our parents raised us, how we were treated in school, all of those things kind of come together to form our wants, our desires, our sense of what's important to us, of what we need. So there is kind of this history that we carry along with us that it seems really entwined with this wanting. Now, there's other things too that seem to impact us. You know, the weather, seasons, things like that. You know, the weather can impact our moods. The seasons can also impact our emotions. So, you know, there's all kinds of things that come together that create our sense of suffering. So, you know, if you have something called seasonal affective disorder, you know, if you're the light, there's not enough light, you may tend to get depressed in the winter. So, you know, there's some genetic component there, there's a seasonal component there, and then there is probably some reactivity also to that sense of depression, you know, that this is not okay, this has to be fixed somehow. So the conditions from history, you know, that's kind of what we carry along with us. But what I'd like to propose is that the actual feeling of dissatisfaction, the feeling of unsatisfactoriness, is created right in the moment. You know, you may have something kind of lingering from your childhood that, you know, memory comes up about that, and it feels like the suffering is right there with that memory that comes up. And, you know, somebody does something that reminds you of that experience, and you're right back in that feeling. It sometimes feels like, you know, there are these wells of emotions that are connected to old conditioning, and that, you know, it's like somebody looks at us funny and we just fall into that well. What I'd like to suggest is that the falling into that well, that feeling of falling into that well of old habitual kind of emotion, there is some history that's coming along, but that feeling is being created right now. Suffering, the feeling of unsatisfactoriness is created in the moment. It's not that feeling is like waiting, lurking for us. There's a kind of a way in which it is. I mean, it's kind of like we've got this baggage that we're carrying around with us. Only we're not carrying it around, it's floating around with us. You know, so there's this heavy baggage that's floating around with us. And the suffering comes when we pick it up. When it's, you know, that's when it gets heavy, is when we pick it up. So if we're not picking it up and it's just floating around with us, it's not particularly a problem. So what I'm suggesting is that that craving, that wanting that causes the suffering of this moment is that picking it up. It's picking that baggage up in the moment. And that's the what we could call the immediate cause of our suffering in the moment, is that picking it up, this reactivity to what is happening in this moment. So I just want to say a little bit of a kind of a, I want to set a context or something around exploring wanting as being the source of suffering. And I said, you know, if we let go of the wanting, the suffering goes away. You know, that if the wanting goes away, the suffering goes away. I'm not saying, it can sound like I'm saying this, but I'm not saying that we don't take action in our lives. You know, that we often think that this kind of wanting, you know, wanting to have things, wanting to get rid of things, is the way that things happen in this world. You know, this is how I get things done, by wanting things. And there's a good amount of things that happen that way. But there are also other ways to get things done, other motivations than this kind of reactive kind of motivation. This reaction of can't have that, gotta have that. There can be motivation out of compassion. There can be motivation out of kindness rather than neediness. So it's kind of an exploration around how can I be skillfully responsive rather than reactive in terms of taking action in the world. It's part of our exploration. So the key piece around this dukkha is this sense of reactivity. I actually like that word as kind of a synonym for dukkha in a way. Because we can have a sense of difference between reacting and responding. You know, the reacting tends to have this sense of it's not okay, it has to be different and it has to be this way. Whereas responsiveness can be more open-hearted and a sense of flowing with the situation as opposed to trying to rigidly control it. So the exploration around this reactivity, the Buddha suggested that for the dukkha of this First Noble Truth, is that we understand it. That's what he suggested. We need to understand this reactivity. So this is a process of learning how to meet our feelings of dissatisfaction, our feelings of loneliness, of despair, of frustration, of anger, of annoyance, of eagerness, of excitement, of greed, of boredom, of loneliness, of being turning towards those feelings. This is what the Buddha was encouraging us to do around understanding suffering. Get to know it, meet it. There's I don't know if you ever heard this when you were a kid. When I was growing up, there was this a kind of a little song that we used to do. It's like, you know, going on a lion hunt, going on a lion hunt. And then you come to a big field of grass, and it's like, oh, you can't go around it, you can't go under it, you can't go over it, you've got to go through it. And then, so you swish, swish through the grass, and then the next thing you come to is a big river, and going on a lion hunt, and there's this big river, and you can't go around it, you can't go under it, you can't go over it, you've got to go through it. Our dukkha is kind of like that. We have to go through it. So how do we use this as a guide this, when we are in a state of struggle, a state of distress, a state of unsatisfactoriness, it means that there is something that is not being accepted, that we're essentially not aligned with the truth of what is actually happening in this moment. And so our suffering, our sense of struggle, points to ways in which we are out of balance. It points to ways in which we're holding on or pushing away something. So anytime there's dukkha, there is some kind of wanting, some kind of wanting things to be other than they are. And so exploring this dukkha, you know, beginning to use it as a guide, use it as a teacher in a way, it shows us where we're clinging. It shows us where we're wanting. If we're willing to explore it, it shows us where we're holding on, where, how we are not aligned with the truth of the moment. There's sometimes a, I don't know, it's kind of a New Age saying I hear sometimes. It's like, we get the lessons we need. And I do think this is true. We get the lessons we need. But it's not because there's some, you know, thing about the universe conspiring to give us these lessons. It's because we are meeting our own minds in every single moment. Whenever there is suffering, we are meeting some struggle in our own minds. This is why we get the lessons we need. Every moment of suffering is pointing us to something that we can learn about how to let go. So I want to explore a little bit about this wanting, you know, how do we explore this? And ways to investigate it, you know, especially in daily life, because that's where we meet a lot of our suffering. You know, the going through our day. So using questions can sometimes be helpful for investigating our struggles. And, you know, in thinking about this talk, I came up with a lot of different ways that I want things. So I thought I'd offer some of those to you. You know, it's amazing, actually, how many things I came up with, ways that I want things. So the first question we can ask ourselves is, what do I want in this situation? You know, just as a kind of an overall question to ask ourselves, you know, what is it that I want? Do I want to have something? You know, do I want to get something? And then, you know, not to just leave it at that, not to just say, okay, oh yeah, I know that's the thing I want. It's so that's kind of a surface level of exploration in a way. You know, a few minutes ago I mentioned, yeah, having an electric car, you know, that would make me happy. I'd love to have an electric car, you know. It doesn't, you know, it's great for the environment, but it also, like, you know, would reduce my need for gas and all kinds of things. So, you know, so there's that wanting, and, you know, so you can know that you have that wanting, but then looking a little bit underneath that, you know, why? Why do I want that? You know, what's motivating that wanting? There may be a kind of a feeling of insecurity or something, you know, around gas costs so much money these days. You know, if I had an electric car, I wouldn't have to buy that gas, and then, you know, I'd have a little bit more money in the bank. So, you know, so there could be a little bit of insecurity or something motivating that one. So not to just stop at looking at, you know, what is it that I want, but to kind of explore underneath, you know, what is there a kind of an emotion that's motivating that wanting? I think for all of these questions, we can ask that. Is there something underneath that wanting? So do I want to have something? The kind of the motivation of greed in a way, but also can be motivated by many other, deeper senses of insecurity or fear or vulnerability. Do I want to get rid of something? And to me, for me, related to that question, do I want to get rid of something, is do I want to fix or change something? Very often, at least for me, the fixing and changing is often about getting rid of something. You know, oh, if I only fix that thing, if I only change that thing, it's not going to be that unpleasant thing. You know, So the fixing and changing for me is related to this wanting to get rid of. Do I want to be seen? Do I want to be recognized? These are big ones for us. Wanting to be seen, wanting to be recognized, wanting to be acknowledged. You know, that somehow we feel that it's very important for us to have these. Do I want to somehow not be here? Do I want to kind of become the invisible person? You know, just get me out of here. Or do I want to, you know, have a certain kind of persona? Do I want to be the one who's perceived as being in charge? Do I want to be the one who's perceived as being important? So this is a little bit kind of subtler wanting, you know, wanting to have certain, kind of related to being seen, you know, but being seen in a certain way, you know, wanting to be seen in a certain way. Is that what's up? Or wanting a particular mind state, you know. As we start to explore this meditation, we get tastes of perhaps some calm or peacefulness or tranquility. And then we, you know, find ourselves agitated. It's like, I don't want this agitation. I want that peacefulness back. So do we want to find ourselves in certain mind states? Do we want to know what to do? This one for me comes up in a kind of transition state, you know, when there's a kind of a place where things are ending and I'm not sure what the next thing is. There can be a real sense of wanting to know, what do I need to do here? And then there can be suffering around the practice itself, actually, kind of related to what I just said about, you know, as we start to touch into kind of peaceful states in our meditation, we kind of want those instead of these states of agitation. You know, it's kind of like, okay, I'm seeing this anger. Yep, I'm supposed to be with this anger, but, you know, I don't like this anger. I want to get rid of this anger. So we get an agenda around our experience, so what we think is good experience, what we think is bad experience. So part of the process around this exploration of turning to our suffering, going through it, like going through the grass, going through it, is learning how to be non-reactive to that reactivity. Now, that's a big part of our practice, is learning how to not react to these difficult states. One thing that in an exploration around this dissatisfactoriness, this struggle, this dukkha, I've seen in my own experience, and I think in a lot of people that I've talked to, that the small ways that we suffer are a reflection of the large ways that we suffer. So, you know, if you have patterns, it may be the other way, actually, that the large ways we suffer are a reflection or an augmentation of the small ways that we suffer. So an example from my own practice, my own experience around transitions. I just mentioned this. I found that when I came to a transition point in my life where, you know, there were big choices to make, I got really uncomfortable. This was not a comfortable place for me to be, and I got really impatient for that to be over. Impatient to the extent that I would just pick anything. You know, it's like, just get me out of this state. I just do not want to be in this state. And, you know, more recently, in exploring my, you know, just my day, going through my day, you know, there's transitions all over the place in our day. You know, we finish one thing and we move on to the next, and we finish that thing and move on to the next. So there's transitions all over the place. And I started recognizing, you know, I'm finishing with my shower. And, you know, I've got, you know, just a couple more things to finish, you know, rinse the shampoo out of my hair or whatever. And this impatience starts welling up. And it's like, it's time to finish with this. It's time to get on to the next thing. And I realized that, you know, it's the same pattern on a small scale as the pattern when there's the transition of a big transition. It's the same pattern on a small scale. And so if you have some big ways that you suffer, some major kinds of patterns in your life, look and see if there are some small ways that that same pattern manifests. So if you know, despair is a problem at times. You know, are there small ways in which there's that flavor of probably not full-blown despair, but a sense of, oh, why does it have to be this way? If you can begin to meet the small ways that you suffer, just, you know, looking through your day, you know, it's like sometimes we just skip right over those. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, that's, you know, it's not a big deal, you know, this impatience of getting out of the shower, it's not a big deal, you know. So we tend to kind of just brush them by, you know. We don't tend to really pay that much attention to them. But I, you know, I think it's really important to pay attention to those small ones, because, first of all, it gives us a sense of what it means to meet these difficult energies on a small scale. So that if you can meet your impatience at transitions, if, you know, for me, meeting my impatience at transitions on the small scale helps me to be with it on when there's a bigger transition. So this is actually something I find very important and helpful, to not kind of overlook the small ways in which we suffer, because they are the seeds of the large ways in which we suffer. It's kind of like there's a feedback pattern in these ways that we tend to suffer. You know, it's like this kind of impatience around transitions, in my experience, you know, if I don't notice or don't pay attention to the impatience around the small experiences, it kind of reinforces that sense of impatience. You know, if I'm not willing to meet that experience and acknowledge it, it's like that. In a way, I might speed up and rush and, like, you know, say, okay, you know, I got it. I will believe my story that the next thing is more important than finishing this. And that kind of cements reinforces this aspect of impatience at a transition. You know, it kind of is like acting on that belief that impatience is motivated from. So if we can, you know, explore these small ways and begin to not be reactive in these small ways. You know, when these small things come up, it's much easier to be mindful of them when the big ones come up. than when the big ones come up. It's much easier to be present for the impatience of getting out of a shower than it is for the impatience around a major life transition. So to explore it in the small gives you the skills and the tools to help you explore it in the large. So look at your own experience and see if this is true for you. You know, if the large ways, if you have kind of major patterns, major life patterns of struggle, look and see if there are ways in which you're reinforcing that pattern all over the place. My suggestion is you'll probably find a lot of ways that you engage in that very same pattern all the time. Okay, so I've got about 7-8 minutes left. So I guess I'll say this one last thing. So sometimes we are exploring our experience, and it doesn't particularly feel like, you know, there's any suffering, and but sometimes we can not have full information. So one of the ways to explore ways in which we may not have full information is to look and see, is there suffering happening around us? You know, we're going through our lives and, you know, saying things to people and doing things with people and, you know, perhaps our intentions are kind and compassionate, but somebody with us is suffering. You know, it's kind of like there's things happening in the wake of our activities. And so, to use the suffering of others also as kind of a feedback for us to explore, you know, to look at what's going on. And so sometimes we can, when there's suffering happening around us, we can check in. Is there something that I don't know here? Is there something that I missed that is allowing the suffering to happen? So is there something to learn around the situation? So this is a way we can unmask misinformation, a way we can unmask misunderstandings, to begin to explore when there is kind of suffering happening around us. Is there something to learn? So I'll give you an example of this. There's a story of a naturalist who, when he was about 11 years old, you know, he was kind of a child naturalist as well, and he had a butterfly collection, and he, was watching the process of these caterpillars spin their chrysalids and, you know, get ready to hatch. And one day he saw one of them kind of beginning to hatch, and it cracked, the chrysalid cracked open, and he watched as the butterfly began to emerge from this cocoon. And he saw how much struggle the butterfly had to go through to push that shell open, and, you know, it was really effortful. And the abdomen of the butterfly got really distended and all this fluid came out, and it was like, you know, this little kid thought this looked awful. You know, it's like, so when the next chrysalid started to crack open, he thought he'd make himself useful, and he eased the crack open a little bit so they wouldn't have to struggle so much. And the butterflies slid out of the cocoons, walked around for a little while, and died. So this was actually a lesson that he was talking about into his 70s. You know, that what seems to be kind and is meant as kind can sometimes be the reverse. In this case, because of misunderstanding and misinformation. So, you know, to look at that, to observe, okay, there was suffering here. You know, something happened. My intention was good. But we can't just go around saying, you know, well, my intention was good. You know, if there's suffering happening around me, it's their problem. You know, sometimes when our intention is good, if there's suffering happening around us, it means there's something for us to learn. You know, what? So to explore that part, I mean, we don't want to take on a guilt for the suffering of others, but a willingness to recognize, okay, if there's suffering happening here, is there something that I didn't know? Is there something that I need to learn? So not to beat ourselves up, not to take on guilt, but to, move forward, essentially. So as usual, I have more to say, but I'm going to stop. Are there any comments or questions? Yeah. Use the mic.
It's a cobbler's children.
With the larger aspect of dukkha that is more readily seen because it's gross and manifests in larger ways, it's actually, I find it harder to see the more subtler aspects of dukkha. It's
You're talking about the large and the small, kind of? Yeah,
the contrast.
Well, it is harder to see the small ones because, you know, it's like they're so subtle in a way that we just kind of, miss them.
Yeah.
So what I'm suggesting, though, is to kind of, can you get familiar with the patterns of the large ones and then start to see, I mean, like for myself, you know, when I began recognizing this large pattern around major transitions, it's like, okay, well, you know, let me look at transitions in the small. You know, so seeing a kind of context in which the suffering came up, I could look at, are there similar contexts that are happening, you know, all the time? So that's a way to kind of begin to see that or look for that.
What's another thing? So I've observed aspects of pleasant and unpleasant vedana transitioning and happening at times very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, and I haven't been able to explore this enough, but maybe you could point me or some insight, that there seems to be kind of a biological aspect of if it's pleasant, going towards it, if it's unpleasant, pushing it away. And in a way, the pushing it away or the grasping for it is a form of, could be construed as a form of dukkha, of grasping and as a hindrance, just sort of in its raw mm-hmm. state.
Mm-hmm.
So does that point to there are built-in habits of aversion and desire at every moment to counter the pleasant, unpleasant vagueness?
You know, my understanding is that the way our nervous system is set up, I mean, yes, there's a biological thing. I mean, you take an amoeba,
right.
You know, it doesn't have much choice. You know, it goes towards the pleasant, it goes away from the unpleasant, it does that thing that amoebas do. The way our nervous system's set up, there's a lot of layers between the experience of pleasant and unpleasant and the contact between of something being pleasant and unpleasant and our actual experience of it. Mm. And
you say the experience, the interpretation, maybe?
Well, the mind recognizing it, let's say.
Okay.
And my understanding is that the reactivity in the human mind is not hardwired. So it is possible to break it. Although it happens at a very deep level, so it's hard to break it. But it is possible. So that it is, that's my understanding, is that, you know, and in doing some reading around neurobiology, I think it bears that out, actually, that there is, there's a little bit of a gap there in which we can choose whether we react to that pleasant and unpleasant. You don't have to believe it.
We can choose to react if we see it, and if it's so subtle.
Oh, if we're not seeing it, we will react in whatever habitual way we react. So is your question then that is it possible to see all of it?
I guess, well, you know, part of...
Mindfulness can get really subtle.
I'm not quite sure what my question is. It's wrapped up around aspects of hindrances, kliksas, and just the path to freedom, and how if one is biologically trapped in this dance of reaction.
See, this is what I'm saying. You're not biologically trapped in it.
Oh, yeah.
My understanding is that we are not biologically trapped in that reactivity. Mm-hmm. That it is possible biologically, I mean that it is not hardwired biologically that that reaction happen. You have to be present to see the pleasant unpleasant,
right,
to be able to have the mind not react.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not trapped. That's my understanding.
Good to
know.
Yeah,
that's the good news.
That's what we're
trying to see in our mindfulness. Yeah. So it is after 9, so we need to stop. So
thank you.
Thank you.